From WBHM News, I'm Richard Banks. School can be tough when you're a kid, with some students experiencing stress, anxiety, and depression. Some schools in the Birmingham area are using what are known as facility dogs in the classroom to help improve students' mental health. WBHM's Miranda Fulmore met a couple of the pups.
On a recent morning, a class of third graders at West Elementary School in Vestavia Hills patiently waited for Merlin's arrival. He's a four-year-old black lab.
Class.
The students break out their favorite books and gather on the rug at the front of the room. They're reading out loud to Merlin to practice their reading skills. Merlin's a good listener as he's sprawled out on the rug.
It's November. There's a chill in the air. The forest is on the pumpkin.
When Merlin isn't being read to, the teacher incorporates him into class. Students try to teach him the latest math lesson or he's used in class examples. But his biggest job is to make the students feel better.
If you're sad, he can, cheer you up, and, he's so sweet and calm.
Merlin is a facility dog, and he helps with sadness.
He, knows if you're sad. He can, sniff it out.
That was Elijah Hahn, Sarah Grace Miserini, and River Henderson. Merlin's handler, Don Norris, who's also the school's counselor, says he uses scent training to tell when students are upset or stressed out.
He went in and smelled and then settled right underneath the little friend who I know is having a really hard time at home. And so it wasn't a surprise to me who he picked, but it's just amazing kind of watching him figure that out.
Facility dogs are similar to service dogs who might help someone who is blind, but facility dogs are trained to handle larger crowds, especially groups of young children. They're also equipped to de-escalate a variety of situations. Nora says this can really help when a child is experiencing a mental health crisis or stress. Mental health is the top concern related to Alabama kids between the ages of 6 and 13. That's according to a recent report released by Children's of Alabama that surveyed parents, teachers, and medical professionals. A separate study released last year shows that facility dogs can actually help with students' mental health. It revealed that having a facility animal reduced the student's stress hormone, cortisol. When Merlin isn't in the classroom, he's usually participating in group sessions that work on friendship, self-esteem, and making good choices. Norris, Merlin's handler, says he also spends a lot of time doing one-on-one sessions with students.
If we have a child who is just having a hard time and anything that we do is not helping, he's a totally different tool, and so far 100% of the time has proved to be able to just diffuse the situation, help the situation.
But Merlin's work as a facility dog is something of a family affair.
Does that smell good?
Yeah.
It might smell like your sister.
Yeah.
Merlin's sister Foxy is only a few miles down the road at Edgewood Elementary School in Homewood. The duo comes from a lineage of facility dogs. They spent years training with Service Dogs of Alabama. Fran Woodruff is the school's librarian and Foxy's handler. She says they largely hang out in the library so students can stop by whenever they're free.
She understands that she is here to provide unconditional love, and the kids make great use of that.
One of Foxy's regular visitors is Rosie Cooper. The fourth grader says she tries to see Foxy twice a week. Cooper says Foxy makes her feel at home.
So I have anxiety disorder, and so Foxy, when I have an anxiety attack, she always helps me. She helps me get out of it, and that's what I love about her.
Woodruff says having a school dog makes a big difference, not just for the students, but also the faculty and staff. She's seen teachers rearrange their schedules to spend time with Foxy.
It's such a simple thing to add to a school. And I think every school should have a school dog, at least one, if not more than one.
As for Foxy, she seems to agree.
Oh. Okay, good girl.
Miranda Fulmore, WBHM. A private landfill that's been burning for more than 2 months in St. Clair County is causing a laundry list of health concerns for nearby residents. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency recently detected above normal levels of toxic chemicals in the air. The agency is spending millions of dollars to put out the fire, which could take another month. Many residents say they're sick and worry about possible long-term health impacts. WBHM's Mary Scott Hodgen reports.
The weekend after Thanksgiving, Chrissy Harmon woke up around 2 a.m. to the smell of smoke.
I actually thought the house was on fire.
The fumes were coming from the nearby landfill that sits on a hill about half a mile from Harmon's house.
As soon as I figured out that it was a fire that was affecting the landfill, I thought they would put it out.
Instead, Harmon and her neighbors have been breathing in the smoke for more than 2 months, and it's taken a toll.
Nosebleeds and upper respiratory junk, headaches have been terrible.
Cough, congestion, sinus problems, headaches, nosebleeds, chest pains.
Sinus issues for sure, coughing, headaches, dizziness.
That's Chrissy Harmon, Frank Reed, and Daniel Cash. Reed lives directly in front of the landfill, and Cash is a few houses down the street. In total, more than 500 people live in the wooded residential area that surrounds the smoldering pit. Jeff Wycliffe is a professor of environmental health sciences at UAB.
2 months is a long time to be in the proximity of a burning landfill, especially one that we may not be entirely sure what's in the landfill.
The landfill is not regulated by state officials. It's supposed to be for natural debris, like trees and leaves. But state records show the dump has contained appliances, power poles, and construction materials in the past. One of the chemicals detected in EPA air samples is an industrial solvent, only found in non-natural products like paint thinners. Other chemicals are known to come from burning wood, as well as burning rubber and plastics. Wycliffe says the detected pollutants have been linked to serious health issues, like cancer, but it's hard to predict the impact of the fumes coming from the landfill.
A lot of what we know about the sort of the short-term immediate health effects of a lot of these chemicals are really based on very high concentrations, much higher than you find here. We really don't know what the effects might be over, say, a two-month period for some of these.
Wycliffe says, in general, smoke inhalation is never good, especially for people with pre-existing conditions like asthma, chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, and heart disease. State and local authorities have told residents to seek medical care if they feel sick and relocate if necessary. Daniel Cash, who lives down the hill from the landfill, says that's frustrating.
We live in a mobile home, an old mobile home at that.
Cash says he can't afford to relocate, and he's never been able to get approved for homeowners insurance, which has helped some people move during the fire.
To some people, it may be an option, but definitely not everybody can just pick up and go, you know.
Chrissy Harmon does have insurance, but she still isn't able to leave.
We have a disabled child. We can't really take him just anywhere.
Harmon's insurance has helped pay for professional air scrubbers and 7 air purifiers. Nearby, Frank Reed says he spent hundreds of dollars on purifiers and cleaning supplies. His house is one of the closest to the fire, right across the street. Reed says he cannot escape the fumes. He's been prescribed nasal sprays, antibiotics, and steroids. He's hopeful that the EPA will soon extinguish the fire, but Reed worries about lingering impacts.
You know, who knows what could happen 10 years from now? I mean, am I going to end up with some weird cancer, you know, that's rare and maybe treatable, maybe not? Who knows? You know, I mean, those are the things that we all have to live with now.
Reed says he'll always wonder what chemicals might have been burning weeks ago before anyone ever tested the air. Mary Scott Hodgen, WBHM.
WBHM Zoe McDonald contributed to reporting this story.
From WBHM News, I'm Richard Banks. U.S. Senator Katie Britt delivers a fiery speech urging support for Israel while on a congressional fact-finding trip to that country. From Tel Aviv, Britt talked of watching videos and hearing stories of the initial attack on Israelis by Gaza-based Hamas militants more than 2 weeks ago. She described acts as disgusting, despicable, and pure evil. Roughly 1,400 Israelis were killed, most in that first wave of attacks. Britt said that while she believes people of, quote, all faiths can coexist in peace and prosperity, she also said the U.S. stands with Israel.
We want Hamas to be destroyed, and we want peace to be restored.
More than 4,600 residents of the Gaza Strip have been killed and more than 1 million displaced due to fighting between Israel and Hamas. U.S. Representative Gary Palmer, a Republican from Hoover, is one of nine congressmen running for Speaker of the House. Considered a surprise candidate, Palmer announced his run for the position on the social media platform X just before yesterday's deadline. Palmer has represented Alabama's 6th congressional district since 2015. The 69-year-old voted against certifying the results of the 2020 election and went further, signing an amicus brief that asked the Supreme Court to throw out electoral votes from key swing states. He says he can unite the Republican Party with steady conservative leadership. And voters will go to the polls tomorrow in a runoff election for the Alabama House District 55 seat. That district covers parts of Birmingham and its western suburbs. There's no Republican in the race, so the winner of the Democratic runoff is expected to take the seat. As WBHM's Kelsey Shelton reports, just because both candidates are from the same party doesn't mean they're focused on the same issues.
Sylvia Swain's campaign is a historic one. If elected, Swain would be Alabama's first openly transgender representative, but she hopes she can be a voice for all disenfranchised groups.
When we work together and we recognize that none of us are free until all of us are free, there is overlap, there is allyship there, there's solidarity.
One of her biggest goals is expanding Medicaid, something she knows will be difficult in an almost entirely Republican House. But she says she's up for the challenge. She's ready to have those tough conversations in order to get things done. Swain's opponent in the race is Travis Hendricks.
I will never stop fighting to eliminate barriers to opportunities, resources, and rights because you deserve a great quarter of life.
Hendricks did not respond to an interview request from WBHM, but according to his website, he has a background in law enforcement, so he's made public safety a big part of his platform. Hendricks' upbringing in the district is also important to him. It has made him aware of issues that affect the area. The race hasn't gone without conflict. On Thursday, a flyer some saw as transphobic aimed at Swain made its way around the district. Hendricks says he didn't create, nor does he support, the flyer. Kelsey Shelton, WBHM.
You'll find more news anytime at WBHM.org.
From WBHM News, I'm Andrew Yeager. One of Alabama's most unique flowers is in full bloom for just a few more weeks. The Cahaba lily grows in the middle of moving water and is only found in three southern states. Environmental advocates say lily season is a time to celebrate, but also to raise awareness of growing threats to the species. For this month's Outdoor Connections, WBHM's Mary Scott Hodgen took a canoe trip to learn more and see the blooms up close.
They all bloom, they're all good.
I'm with about two dozen people lined up along the banks of the Cahaba River in Bibb County. We buckle into life jackets and delicately climb into canoes.
Everybody got a seat in the boat?
Will Rayner leads the trip. He's the field programs director at the Cahaba River Society. Rayner says we're in for a treat.
We are about to paddle down through the Cahaba River National Wildlife Refuge to go see the Cahaba lilies, a very, very cool flower that's pretty geologically remote.
Cahaba lilies are big white flowers with spider-like petals. Each flower blooms for just one day, usually between mid-May and June. Alabama is thought to be home to the largest Cahaba lily population in the world, located about a mile downstream from where we begin paddling. The ride is mostly smooth, even for novice paddlers like myself. We soon arrive at a large field of white flowers in the middle of the river. We park our canoes and carefully walk along the smooth rocks. Scientist Randy Haddock stands near a clump of lilies.
These seem to like this kind of habitat, what they're called is foliate rocks or flat rocks.
Haddock has studied the Cahaba and its biodiversity for decades. He says the lily bulbs like to wedge into the rocks along the riverbed and nest there. It's a dynamic and vulnerable habitat. Haddock points to a menacing pile of dead trees and limbs floating near the flowers.
Folks, what do you suppose is going to happen with the next high water event when that thing floats away? There's a good chance it's going to knock these down or knock them loose.
Haddock says that's now a bigger threat than ever before. And it's because of what's happening upstream.
What's going on in Birmingham has a lot to do with what happens right here in this kind of special place, right?
To understand the problem, travel about 50 miles north to the banks of the Cahaba River near Hoover.
So, this is,
I did not realize this was like the Grand Canyon.
Yeah.
Ben Wegleitner and Katie Shaddix stand above the river at a spot where it makes a sharp turn. The banks here look like they've been cut with a knife. Wegleitner, who's with the Cahaba River Society, says over the years, water has eroded large sections of land, exposing roughly 20 feet of dirt along the curve.
So sites like this are persistent sediment contributors to the Cahaba River.
Today, water levels along the Cahaba appear to be more volatile than ever before. The river rises and falls increasingly fast to dangerous levels. And that ties back to stormwater management, how we deal with rainfall. Wegleitner says we like to move it away from us, keep water off of our roads and out of our yards.
But what that does is it speeds up water getting to the Cahaba River, and we're seeing the erosive effect that that has. It brings trees into the river. The collapsing banks will often dislodge trees from the banks and send them downriver.
Downriver, where those trees can plow through clumps of Cahaba lilies, and sediment can fill in the precious space between rocks, where lily seeds and many other creatures like to nest.
Some of them don't have a lot of room.
Seeing the lilies up close, that information hits home for people on the canoe trip.
I didn't really realize that that had a way downstream effect, and it does.
Sam Foley attended the trip with his wife, Dale Foley. They say they're glad to see more awareness of the issue and growing efforts to address it. Some developers are adding retention ponds, and more cities are supporting green development. The Foleys say it's a worthy investment to protect the river and the lilies.
Beautiful.
Beautiful. I mean,
we've only ever seen them, you know, from a distance, never been out here, you know, walking around amongst them, so it's very nice.
Cahaba expert Randy Haddock says for now, the lily population appears to be stable. He says it's an incredibly resilient species that people rally around.
It's something that has just kind of become a symbol for the Cahaba. And it's just something that has inspired a lot of love and appreciation.
Haddock says local scientists have discovered a lot about the lilies. But at the end of the day, people are drawn to the flowers because they're big and showy, and they're a bit mysterious. White lilies growing in the middle of moving water, making an appearance just one day a year. Mary Scott Hodgin, WBHM.
You can learn more about the lilies this weekend at the Cahaba Lily Festival. That's Saturday in West Blocton. This story is part of our monthly series, Outdoor Connections, which features stories that explore the biodiversity of Alabama and how we depend on it. If you have an idea for the series, you can email maryscott@wbhm.org. From WBHM News, I'm Andrew Yeager. Alabama's senior senator Tommy Tuberville has roiled some in the military by blocking Department of Defense nominations. It's in protest of new Pentagon policies concerning abortions. Tuberville spoke with WBHM's Richard Banks recently about the move, but they began their conversation with another issue the Republican has pushed, an effort to bar transgender women from participating in women's sports.
Given all the initiatives you're working on in the Senate, why put so much focus on this topic compared to other issues that affect Alabamians?
It's going to affect everybody all over the country. And the problem we're having in the next couple of weeks is Joe Biden, he's legislating from the White House, and he's basically doesn't care about women's sports in Title IX. He's going to take a sledgehammer to it, because this next couple of weeks he's going to executive order any school in 2023, starting this year, if you do not abide by his law in terms of males playing against women in sports, you'll lose your federal funding. Title IX is going to go under if we continue to get this type of legislation from Joe Biden.
The DOD nominations, you have single-handedly blocked critical Department of Defense nominations to protest new Pentagon policies, ensuring that service members have access to reproductive health care, including reimbursement for service members who must travel to obtain abortions. Military leaders, as well as members of your own Republican Party, have expressed concern, even outright frustration, over your hold on these nominations. Let's say your actions have no effect on military readiness, a claim that you made in a press release and an op-ed. However, How do you think those actions look to our military adversaries?
Well, it goes back to one thing that I talked about, legislating from the White House and from the Department of Defense. We've had an abortion policy. This is not about abortion. We've had abortions for years in the military. We have a law in this country called the Hyde Amendment that says taxpayer money will not be used for abortion because some people believe in it, some people don't. Again, this is changing the policy from the White House.
You've established your concern where Biden's policies are, but the question was, how do you think these actions look to our adversaries?
Well, you know, I'm on the Armed Services Committee, and I go through all these hearings and listen to all these generals, four-star, all their combatant commanders. And if we think this is a problem, we're showing our adversaries we're weak. All we got to do is go back and look at Joe Biden's what he's done to our military with the woke ideas, with the CRT that we're teaching in our military. We are losing in the military so fast our readiness in terms of recruitment. And why? I can tell you why. Because the Democrats are attacking our military, saying we need to get out the white extremists, the white nationalists, people that don't believe in our agenda as Joe Biden's agenda. They're destroying it. This year, we will not reach any recruiting goals in the military. So if we want to talk about looking weak, that's where we're going to look weak. We cannot start putting rules in there for one type, one group, and make different factions in the military, because that is the most important institution in the United States of America and our allies, is a strong, hard-nosed killing machine, which is called our military.
You mentioned the Biden administration trying to prevent white nationalists from being in the military. Do you believe they should allow white nationalists in the military?
Well, they call them that. I call them Americans. What happened after January the 6th, and I was here on January the 6th, we were attacked on the Senate floor saying that all these people that came into the Capitol were extremists. They were against the country. There was a lot of people, there was probably 100 of them that came in, broke windows and broke doors that should have been locked up. That's not how we do it in America, but there were hundreds of thousands that didn't come in outside that were true Americans that believe in this country. But right after that, we, our military and Secretary Austin put out a order to stand down and all military across the country saying, we're going to run out the white nationalists, people that don't believe how we believe. And that's not how we do it in this country. We have got so much division up here that not for the country. You know, this is not for any individual, this country. This country is for all of us, and we're all the same. It doesn't make any difference. You're rich, poor, black, white. It doesn't make any difference. Everybody as an American has opportunity to make this country better. We've made it 247 years, but I'm going to tell you what, We're walking a tightrope right now. How much longer this country is going to make it, as we all know it.
That was Republican U.S. Senator Tommy Tuberville speaking with WBHM's Richard Banks. We have more context around the senator's comments at WBHM.org.
From Birmingham, I'm Miranda Fulmore. Alabama has some of the nation's toughest restrictions on dispensing Narcan, a nasal spray that can reverse an opioid overdose. But last week, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration approved Narcan to be sold over the counter. Public health officials say it's a potential game changer. WBHM's Mary Scott Hodgen reports on how health officials hope to expand access to the life-saving drug.
In the small town of Fayette, Nicole Hall stands in front of a group of police officers. They're quiet, settling in for a two-hour training. But Hall brings the energy.
All right, are y'all ready to get started on Narcan?
Yes, I love the excitement.
Hall works with an outreach program run by the University of Alabama. She travels around the western part of the state to lead Narcan trainings for first responders.
This is our first one in Fayette, which I'm so incredibly excited about because the rural community really, really needs these services.
An hour and a half drive west of Birmingham, Fayette is home to a few thousand people and a police force of 10 officers. Jordan Roberts has served on the force for about 6 years. He's never used Narcan, but he sees a growing need for it.
And each day that goes by, the more and more that we are seeing that fentanyl is becoming a problem.
Fentanyl is a powerful opioid that has all but taken over the illicit drug supply. Just a small amount can trigger an overdose. Narcan can reverse it. The nasal spray is safe and easy to use. Austin Palmer says he's used it a lot. He lives in Fayette and serves on the police force in Carbon Hill, a small community in Walker County.
Narcan is like magic. I have seen it do some crazy things.
He says he's used Narcan to revive people who were on the brink of death. Palmer says he and other officers try to carry the life-saving drug with them at all times, but it's not easily accessible.
We have bought Narcan out of our own pockets before, just because it's been kind of hard for us to get it. Like right now, I've got one dose left.
Under Alabama law, anyone can use Narcan to try to save someone's life. But only certain medical providers, like doctors, pharmacists, and public health nurses, can give out the medication. So at training events like the one in Fayette, officers learn how to use Narcan, but they don't receive it, because most outreach groups don't have a doctor or pharmacist on staff. To get the nasal spray, first responders and residents can buy it from a pharmacy, or if they want it for free, they can go through the Jefferson County Department of Health.
And you can say this is a kit that is a Jefferson County resident.
At the JCDH headquarters in Birmingham, Dr. Darlene Traffenstedt and a colleague go through a stack of cardboard boxes full of Narcan. Every week, they mail out hundreds of kits to people all over the state who complete an online training. Traffenstedt is a medical director at JCDH. She says every kit that gets mailed out is dispensed under her medical license. It's a way to expand access while following Alabama's strict requirement.
In Alabama, there's a firm stance that if it is a prescription medication, it must be dispensed by someone who has special training in prescribing and dispensing medications. We've done everything that we can to work within that restriction, and no doubt that that restriction has limited access.
Traffenstedt says it would be ideal if the health department could give a bulk supply of Narcan kits to community groups that train first responders and groups that work directly with people who have substance use disorders.
We want them to be able to provide it right then.
She says now that Narcan is approved to be sold over the counter, that should soon be possible because state restrictions around who can dispense the medication will go away.
What will not go away is the cost barrier.
Once Narcan is available at grocery stores and supermarkets, it's expected to cost as much as $50 or more. But Traffenstedt says the health department will keep offering it for free, and they hope to soon give more of it to groups like Nicole Hall's.
Do y'all have any questions or anything? Did I teach you anything at all? Yes!
At the training event in Fayette, Hall says she's excited to see expanded access to Narcan. She hopes to make it easier for first responders to access the medication.
I'm going to be completely and totally honest. These are just big dreams. We're uncertain about what it will and won't look like, you know. But theoretically, it could be just a situation where at something like this, we can actually just bring the Narcan with us and give it to the department afterwards.
For now, officers have to get the nasal spray via mail from the state health department. Narcan is expected to be available over the counter in a few months. Mary Scott Hodgen, WBHM.
To learn how to use Narcan and request a free kit, visit jcdh.org.
From WBHM News, I'm Andrew Yeager. This summer, headlines have screamed climate change. Globally, July was the hottest month on record. Smoke from forest fires choked many parts of the U.S., and the Gulf of Mexico hit a record high for average weekly sea surface temperatures. Here in Alabama, we've been spared the harshest effects of climate change, but that appears to be changing. WBHM's Richard Banks begins a week-long series on climate change called Alabama's Hot Topic, What Climate Change Could Bring.
With three decades of farming under his belt, Andy Millard knows what to look for in a peach.
Man, it's like a golden, it's a real red blush to it with a golden yellow texture. So when we go to pick, that's what we're looking for.
But the best way to tell if peaches are ripe enough for picking is to take a bite.
And if it tastes good, then you're like, okay, we need to get in here and pick.
But this season, there were a lot fewer peaches to pick on Millard's trees.
This year was unlike many others that we've had when we've lost peaches or had damage.
He estimates he lost up to 80% of his crop at Mountain View Orchards in Chilton County, the farm he runs with his family. What hurt the peaches was a 1-2 punch of record-breaking heat in February, followed by a cold snap in mid-March. The heat signaled to his peach trees to start producing fruit that were then damaged by the cold.
So then we get to March. The peaches, we had some peaches on the tree about the size of a dime, a nickel, and they're very vulnerable at that stage. And when it dropped down to 24, 25, it put a hurting on them.
Climate change is warming the planet, and that heating creates havoc with the weather.
So we're seeing more extremes.
That's Jim McClintock, a climate researcher and professor of polar and marine biology at UAB.
Here in Alabama, we're seeing colder colds and hotter hots. We are seeing heavier rainfall that results in flooding events that are unprecedented.
Catherine Hayhoe is a climate scientist and professor at Texas Tech. She says the effects of climate change go beyond just the weather.
Inflation is already increasing measurably because of climate change, and the inflation rate on food is increasing twice as much because of climate-fueled disasters.
She adds housing prices are being affected, as are insurance rates for those who live in vulnerable areas. Fuel prices often increase after natural disasters, intensified by climate change, when they hit along the Gulf, and people are affected through increased heat-related illnesses. The Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change released its latest report in March. It's the gold standard for global research on the topic. The study stated that human activities, mainly the emission of huge amounts of heat-trapping greenhouse gases like carbon dioxide, have already altered the planet at a pace and scale unequaled in recorded history. UAB's Jim McClintock says the message is clear.
The IPCC report said to me that we are very close to reaching a point where we are going to pay a price if we don't radically decrease the amount of CO2 that we're putting in the atmosphere.
Hayhoe agrees and says climate change has a particularly dangerous effect on states along the Gulf of Mexico. Data shows water temperatures in seas are rising to more and more dangerous levels, possibly making hurricanes and land-based storms stronger, much more damaging, even more deadly. Alabama may be playing catch-up to the rest of the world. Temperatures in the second half of the 20th century were actually comparatively cooler before rising in recent years. According to First Street Foundation, a climate research nonprofit, the Gulf and southeastern Atlantic regions face the country's best chance of having more 100-degree days over the next three decades.
I have serious concerns about the future of the Gulf states. If you look at the impacts of climate change, they affect us all, but they don't affect us all equally, and the Gulf states are in the crosshairs.
Hayhoe emphasizes we can still prevent further damage. We just need to act now, because climate change appears to be on a fast track. Richard Banks, WBHM.
In the next story in our series, Alabama's Hot Topic, we'll zero in on the dangers of rising temperatures and what can be done to mitigate the effects of a hotter Alabama. From WBHM News, I'm Andrew Yeager. Tradition is a big part of the holiday season. Last week, during our News and Brews community pop-up in Calera, we asked some of those who stopped by about their unique traditions. This morning, we take a listen to what they had to say.
Hi, my name is Jackie Batson, and I'm from Calera, Alabama. My family's unique holiday tradition is that we always go to a movie on Christmas Day. When I was growing up, we would have all of our presents and gift opening and, you know, all the big stuff was done on Christmas Eve. So Christmas Day seemed a little anticlimactic. So even when I was a child, my mother and I would sneak off and go see a movie every Christmas Day, and we still do it now with our kids.
My name is Becky Bolton, and I grew up in Vestavia Hills, but now I live south of Calera. I guess my favorite thing to think about is going to my grandmother's house, and she had like eight children. They would all bring these amazing dishes and put them all on the table, and the cousins would all get their plates and go up to my grandmother's fireplace room, and we would have our section to have our fun meal in while the adults stayed in the kitchen talking about everything from politics to whatever. I still have Granny's little relish dish, and on one side you had your cranberry sauce and on the other side was pickled peaches, and it's so hard to find pickled peaches, but I found some at Aldi the other day and I bought a jar.
My name's Jonathan McSwain. I'm originally from New Orleans, Louisiana. And I would say my family's unique holiday tradition is the night before, we each open a gift kind of know what it is. It's Christmas-themed pajamas. And we all get into our Christmas-themed pajamas the night before Christmas, sit around, just enjoy each other's time. I was probably in my late 20s, and I'm a comic book nerd, so I forget whose idea it was. They got me a pair of grown man Superman pajamas. So I wore them. We all had a good laugh. I think I still have them somewhere.
My name is Rick Walton, and I am from Calera. A family's unique holiday tradition for me would be my mom's homemade hard rock candy. She started when I was very young, when we were in Michigan, and we would all be in the kitchen and she would be doing the candy, and my dad and I and my brother and sister would be cutting it. And then you use oils, like oil of peppermint, oil of wintergreen for flavorings, and then use food coloring to make it whatever color you want. And the whole house would smell like it. Wintergreen was wonderful. Peppermint, you had to watch. You get too much and you would be crying. It would burn your eyes. Learn that the hard way.
My name is Jack Anderson, and I'm 6 years old. I'm from Calera. My favorite thing to do at the holidays is spend time with my family. When I decorate cookies, they look really cool. I did gingerbread man and gingerbread girl and a stocking and a mitten. Merry Christmas.
Those were people who stopped by our News and Brews community pop-up in Calera last week, talking about their unique holiday traditions. This audio postcard was produced by Kelsey Shelton and Will Dahlberg.